This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, I'm Ken Tangen. This is episode 66 of What's It Like. My guest is Michelle Pouliot, or Pouliot, or Pouliot. I can't get one of it's one of those. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, and it's close enough.
Yes, my name is Tangen, or Tongan, or Tungan, or something like that, and it's always difficult, so you just kind of let them people pick.
That's right. You just kind of give flexible and go with the flow.
And you were somewhere in Oregon.
Yes, near Portland, Oregon. We have Guide Dogs for the Blind has two campuses. The main campus is in the Bay Area near San Rafael, California. Mm-hmm. And this is a satellite campus that we opened in 1994. We're about, 20 minutes from, or maybe a little longer, from the Portland Airport. So near Portland, Oregon.
Oh. Did you grow up in that area?
Not at all. I'm an Air Force brat from way back. So I lived pretty much all over the country and in parts of the world. And when I started working with Guide Dogs for the Blind in 1974 is when I started having roots that I actually lived somewhere longer than just in two-year increments.
Did you come from a large family?
Not at all. I have an older brother who is a truck driver.
Hmm.
And that's the extent of my family. My mother is still alive at 92 years of age.
Wow, good for her.
Yep, still playing golf.
Wow. So in all your moving around, did you have a favorite child possession or something that you carried with you?
Oh, I can't think of any sort of possession. No.
So it was a new adventure every time you went.
Very much so. And my brother and I, neither of us ever looked at all that moving as negative. We were lucky enough that we never moved during school year.
Oh.
It was always during summer. So it certainly put us in the position of meeting new people every few years.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of starting new relationships and new friendships. But a lot of those were with other Air Force children. So, everybody was in the same boat. So, it wasn't like going into an established school system where everyone had grown up in that town. That actually only happened to me one time, which was for my high school. And other than that, the schools were all comprised of the Air Force children.
Hmm. So who had the biggest influence on you growing up?
Very interesting question, because my brother and I were just talking about that last weekend, that how we feel our father impacted us probably greater than anyone, and he actually was around not very much. He was gone a lot, but he had quite an impact on us when he was there. He was a pretty exceptional man, and so I think that he certainly had an impact on me to look for doing things I wanted to do and I had a passion about, and he supported me wanting to make choices towards going with my passion versus normalcy. For instance, I didn't go to college, which he really wanted me to go to college, but I wanted so much to follow my passion of training horses that he allowed me to spend the money on the college to go to a equestrian school.
Oh.
So, that certainly put the whole direction of my life another way, to be able to start training with experts in a field that I thought I would have a passion for, and I did have a passion for. So he certainly, helped me go the direction I ended up, which is working with animals.
So how did an Air Force brat get such a passion for horses?
There's so many young teenage girls that have a love of horses. So I don't know where that comes from, but that's pretty common. Never had a horse until we were stationed in the Philippines at Clark Air Force Base. They had a very large stable on that base, and my father allowed me to get very involved with riding at that stable and let me get my own horse while we were there. We were there for 2 years.
Mm.
And so that's when I became extremely excited and involved and impassioned with working with my horse. And that was you know, at a junior high level of age, which was a very healthy thing to be involved in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very good thing for me to spend all my spare time without the stables and with all the horses and with other peer teenagers who were also interested in horses and not in the typical teenage getting in trouble hobby. So that's where I got my passion initially. And when we came back to the States, we were next stationed in Alexandria, Louisiana, where I went to high school. And on that air base there, called England Air Force Base, they also had a stable. So that worked out to my advantage to be able to, again, have another horse and continue that hobby through high school.
Did you ever want to be an Olympic rider or?
Well, funny you should ask that. The equestrian school that I went to out of high school was the Pacific Coast Equestrian Research Farm, which was run by Linda Tellington Jones and her then husband Wentworth Tellington. And that, of course, changed my whole life. If you look up on the history of Linda Tellington and the Tellington Touch, she's a remarkable woman. And I was there for a year studying, and then I ended up instructing for them also with new students coming in. And during that time, not really knowing much about how to go into a career, they actually made an offer to me to sponsor me with a horse if I wanted to stay amateur and strive to go to the Olympics. And that was extremely tempting. It was very exciting to think of the potential of going to the Olympics with people like Linda and Wentworth behind you. But I don't really know why. I can't think back and remember why I made the decision to go professional and did so. So coming out of that school in around 1970, I made the decision to go professional in the field of horse training and riding instruction.
So you began teaching other people how to ride horses and how to train horses?
Yes, right.
So from horse training, how'd you become a dog trainer?
Very interesting. I still have my passion for horses, but what happened was coming out of Linda Tellington Jones's school, she assisted in setting me up with somebody who was opening up a riding program in North Dakota. And this was a new facility that was being built, and they needed a riding instructor to oversee all of the horse training and the student instruction. So I went to Fargo, North Dakota for a year, and one of my students at that school was a dog trainer in town. Now, I had never had dogs growing up through the Air Force because of all the moving. And as soon as I got settled, and this was actually the first place I was actually being settled and so-called having a home, I got a dog. I chose a Labrador Retriever, probably because I had just seen the movie The Incredible Journey and was in love with Luau from the movie, and I wanted one of those yellow Labradors. So I knew nothing about dogs. But anyway, I got a yellow Labrador and this very nice gal from in town who did basic dog obedience training would trade me. I would give her lessons riding, and then after the lesson, she would work with me in how to train my dog. And I was so enamored with how much easier it was to train a dog than it was a horse. And of course, the methods being used at that time were very traditional type methods.
In both areas.
In both disciplines, mm-hmm. For sure. Yes. And the dogs responded so much better to this traditional training just because as a species, they're so loving and so forgiving
mm-hmm.
of our human errors. And I was just fascinated with how it appeared dogs were quicker learners and it appeared that they were more willing to learn. So I basically, over the next year, decided to flip hobby and profession because I got into the dog thing for a few years as just an amateur and competing with my dog at local obedience trials, and I was really enjoying it. And because I was doing well, people would see me at the trials and ask for help with their dog, and how did I get my dog to do that so happy, and et cetera. And so I just decided, you know, it would be interesting to get into the dog training professionally and just let horses go back to being basically a passionate hobby. And that's kind of what happened. But when I started getting into dogs professionally, that was kind of a difficult step because I had no formal training. And I decided that getting in the ground floor, doing some grunt work, like I worked for a grooming parlor for about 6 months, literally just bathing poodles and blowing them dry so that the people who knew what they were doing could clip and scissor and do all the fancy stuff grooming them. And then I got a job at a kennel in Long Beach, California, basically cleaning kennels and then a few hours a day training client dogs that came in for basic control and basic obedience. So I was starting all over again from my perspective versus already having come somewhere in the horse world. I was reading a magazine and there was an article on guide dog schools and on how these schools trained these dogs to help blind individuals be mobile. And I was so taken with that concept that not only would you be training dogs, which would be what a great career, but on top of it, you would be using that to actually help people. So I was extremely excited about the idea of being a guide dog instructor. And the article gave three schools' names and addresses. And I sent letters of interest to be employed to all three. Well, I only got answers from two. And one of the answers I have, I still have framed on the wall to this day, because it says that women are not physically or emotionally capable of doing this type of work.
Oh, my.
Now, comically, back then, that would be about 1973, that really wasn't something that anyone would get their hackles up at reading.
No.
You know, it's like, I remember reading it thinking, oh, I didn't realize,
yes.
You know, instead of being at all defensive or angry about that. So, you know, it's still actually kind of a comical letter for me to read. But the other letter I got back was from Guide Dogs for the Blind offering me an interview. So I went and I interviewed and very, very ecstatic that they accepted me as an apprentice. And at that time, I was only the second woman that they had hired. Mm. It turns out that the guide dog industry as a whole at that time, which was still a pretty young industry, pretty much hired all men out of the military who had done military dog training.
Mm-hmm.
So that was basically where they got their initial instructors that had some sort of dog training experience. Now, all these years later, 38 years almost here, our staff is almost 98% women.
Hmm.
So it's the field itself has really transformed into a career that many, many women pursue, possibly because of the emotional aspect of it, meaning, you know, the caring and nurturing of the dogs and the emotional aspect of assisting blind individuals, but it's kind of a phenomenon that's been interesting that nobody has really found out why that has happened. It's also happened in the orientation and mobility field where people teach cane travel to blind individuals. A majority of people entering that profession appear to be women also.
Hmm. So what do you actually do?
Well, for about 20 years, I was actually a guide dog trainer in the trenches, training the dogs from the beginning to the end, and training clients routinely. And the past 15 to 18 years, I've been in supervisory level positions and directing training at the campus I'm at here, and now the position I hold, research and development, is geared towards improving our programs, whether that's dog training programs, student instruction programs. Research and development sometimes conjures up, you know, images of a white lab coat, and that's not what I do. What I do is more the concrete, actual hands-on. How do we train the dogs? How do we care for the dogs? How do we bring up our puppies? And how do we serve our clients effectively? In other words, our teaching methods, are they modern, up to date? Are they adult learning programs as they should be versus paternalistic type programs? So I've had the wonderful opportunity since 2001 in this position to help promote and direct change in our organization, which was steeped in historical tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Being a very, you know, the Seeing Eye on the East Coast is the oldest guide dog school in this country, and we are the second at, we started in 1942.
Hmm.
And so all of those historical and very successful techniques that were used were, you know, obviously passed on and on and on through the decades. And when I started in 1974, the methods being used did not look much different than they had in 1942. Not much had changed. And even in the first 10 years that I was working as an apprentice instructor and then a qualified instructor, the techniques had already made notable changes towards, although they were traditional techniques, still trying to be much more positive and praising more of the dog and less corrective, but they were still quite traditional.
So a traditional training approach would be to make a dog do something?
Yes, it would be more based on making the dog do something and obviously giving them positive support with verbal and physical praise when they do it right.
Mm-hmm.
But the dog is not a part of the learning process. Everything's being directed at them.
Mm.
Everything is being made to happen. So yeah, there was a much more element of compulsion, and the old thought in the guide dog industry was that to make a guide dog reliable and safe, there has to be this compulsion element in training them so that they're truly a safe guide. And we've certainly, in the past 10 years, we've proved that wrong.
So is this a militaristic approach in the sense that, you know, so you command the dog to do it and it does it, and is that part of the thinking, or was it part of the thinking?
That was part of the thinking. And interestingly enough, there's a really good reason why that thinking was present. And it was because the people who first did guide dog work in this country were trainers that had done military dog work.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of the people who came out of World War II who had experience of training military dogs, they came back to this country and they were able to put a sign out that says, I'm a dog trainer, and make a living out of that. And all the techniques that they had learned were all based on compulsive type training. So no surprise that the training in our country in general, not just guide dog training, but even pet obedience training, you know, if you look at the decades of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, the majority of training done at that time was traditional, and it's because all of that was passed on from earlier directors, trainers who were trained in those initial traditional methods.
It's still pretty prominent.
Oh, it's still present. The good news is that more and more people who stick with traditional training, it's still a much more positive-based training than it used to be, meaning that they have a much more heavier balance towards trying to give more positive reinforcement, even if it's only in the form of praise and physical touch and verbal, et cetera, and play, tug-of-war, balls, you know, whatever they can do to keep the positive side bigger. That's the good news. Is I call it, my lingo for it is good traditional training. So there is a way to still apply traditional techniques in a much better way than were certainly being applied in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s.
If you watch The Dog Whisperer, you will still see very traditional approaches in presentation.
Exactly. There are certain individuals that are still making a career out of teaching more traditional methods, for sure. Yeah.
But my friend Karen Pryor would be mad at me if I didn't point out the big change that clicker training has made.
Oh, there's no way to even summarize in a sentence what our adoption of clicker training has done for our program. I mean, it's been phenomenal. The reluctance in the guide dog industry as a whole, because of this historic background, the reluctance to even use food as a reward has been really strong. It's been strongly ingrained that because a guide dog has to work around food day in, day out, that you can't use food rewards with guide dogs. And that's just not true. We proved that wrong. And what's true is you do have to be careful in the way you use food reward with guide dog. So, for instance, with a pet dog, like Karen might be training a pet dog with clicker how to do a behavior. Let's say it's go lay on your bed. Well, she has that luxury of being able to, every time she clicks, she can just throw the food down on the floor and let the dog go get it off the floor.
Yes.
In guide dog work, the one thing we don't want the dog having a history of is taking food from the environment. So we hand feed the dog directly. So all our food rewards come directly from the handler and delivered to the dog's mouth, because we also teach the dog how to ignore the cheeseburger that's sitting on the sidewalk.
Yes, you don't want your guide dog, you know, eating this its way down the street.
Exactly. Not only would it be unhealthy, it could actually be lethal with some of the things that people drop on the sidewalk, either accidentally or on purpose. So if something as simple as coolant drained from a car can be lethal, and it's very sweet tasting to dogs. So it's real important for us to make sure that while we're having a program that's based on giving the dog a lot of food reward as positive reinforcement, we have to be careful that the dog is also learning where that reward comes from, and it comes from the handler. So they're not looking even into the environment for food. Mm-hmm.
It seems like people are very supportive of guide dog training, but does it surprise you when strangers try to sabotage the training sessions?
Usually what you're talking about in sabotaging has to just be people that don't understand. You know, everyone loves dogs so much that when you have this beautiful animal out who's obviously behaving itself, so it's all the more impressive of an animal to watch, they just want to run up and pet the dog. Mm-hmm. And so what's very common is while a person is petting the dog, they say, "May I pet your dog?"
Well, at least they ask.
Exactly. And more and more, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and it's so much more common now to have somebody ask before they reach out. And we prepare the dogs anyway. I mean, the reality is the blind handler is going to have so many times sitting on a bus or whatever that they don't even know the person next to them is petting the dog. And the bottom line is, if the dog is used to it and they know that the real meaningful reinforcement comes from their handler, that pet won't be that big a deal.
Yes.
It's true, though, that we continue to try to get the education out to the public that it's dangerous to try to distract a guide that's in the process of working. It would be like you're working at your desk, and I keep popping in, stroking you on the forehead, saying, "You're so cute today." But people don't get that. You know, they need to understand it's no different than if you were busy doing a job and somebody kept coming over and touching you or talking to you in a silly way. You know, you wouldn't do that because you can tell somebody's trying to do a job.
Right.
And when the guide dog is not working and they're just at rest and you ask a blind person if you can pet, most of them will say, "Sure, go right ahead." The only reason that they would not would be, you know what, I know we're not walking right now, but he's in harness and he's considering himself working right now. So please know. And actually, it's just as polite to ask a person with a pet the same thing.
Yes, it is. What's the best thing about your job?
Oh, the best thing about my job is seeing all of the work that we've done to change our program to clicker training and positive reinforcement training pay off and actually make a better guide dog for the blind client than we've ever had before. That's the payoff.
Let me turn the question around. What's the worst thing about your job?
Oh, the worst thing about my job. What would be the worst thing about my job? That's a hard one. I've got a great job. Maybe just that it is a very passionate, emotional career. Because it's emotion-based, it can be difficult for staff, and certainly it's happened to me at times through my career, when management decisions have to be made due to business reasons. And you know, for any business, you know, if you have to either cut staff or cut a program because of resources, it's hard to let go of the emotional aspect of, but that program's really worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that because it isn't a cold type of career, it's not just apples on a production line. It's individual dogs and it's individual blind clients that you're trying to serve. And you may have to turn down a blind client because they're really not prepared with their mobility yet to work a dog effectively. Having to turn a person down when you know how badly they want a guide dog, even though you know the reason I'm turning them down is it probably won't be successful because they're not ready yet, it still is an emotional thing to have to deal with. You know, it isn't just the apple that fell off the production line that you toss in the bin. Yeah, it's so I would say probably if there's a negative, but at the same time, that is one of the positives about the career, is that it's so satisfying emotionally. It's so rewarding. Every day you have things in your face pointing out what a great thing you're doing.
What type of person would be good at your job?
Well, it actually is a quite diverse skill set that's needed, because a lot of people can be very good at training animals. Like, let's just say it's the dog, training dogs. But when it comes to also then instructing a client, and on top of that, a blind client, so not somebody you can demonstrate visuals when you're teaching, to also have that skill to be an effective teacher of how to handle that dog and how to work with that dog and how to maybe even train that guide to do something additional for them. So it's a diverse skill set for somebody who's not only good at training dogs, but also good at conveying that to the client and instructing them effectively on how to handle their dog and motivating the client, because the majority of our first-time guide dog users have never even had a dog before. So even though they think they love dogs and they want a guide dog, to them it's a huge amount of information to learn and absorb. Forget about the guiding part, just about having a dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just about having this animal in your life as a life partner, caring for it effectively, and managing it effectively. And so a lot of motivation goes into the day-to-day work you do with a client that is surrounded by that we know this is hard, but believe me, the outcome in the end is going to be worth all this hard work.
That's like getting married.
Yeah, I mean, if this was easy, we could just pack the dog up by UPS and deliver it with a cassette tape for how to use it. But it's a little more involved than that. So I would say having a passion to help others is certainly important, and having a passion for learning the science of training and learning how species learn effectively, and being prepared for an emotional job that also is a lot of hard work. but the payoff is fantastic emotionally and for satisfying. The majority of this career in the world, there are some exceptions, are nonprofit organizations. So if someone is looking to get into a career where they're going to make a lot of money, this would not be one that you'd put on your list. So, you know, the pay scales have certainly gone up for guide dog instructors since I began. But at the same time, you are working for a nonprofit, and so it isn't going to be the same as getting into another type of business.
Mm-hmm. If someone wanted to pursue it, though, how would they get a job like yours?
Well, that's a good question. One thing that people can do, if they're interested, is go to our website, which is guidedogs.com. That's guidedogs, plural, .com. And there's at the top on the About button, there's a place there about careers, and there's quite a bit of information there about positions that are open and other positions, and those information sheets also kind of give you what the criteria is for each position, which would help drive someone to realize the experience they may want to get. So for sure, you can never have enough practical experience, meaning even if you just donated your time to help at a kennel or at an animal shelter or a humane society shelter, taking care of the dogs, walking them, or getting to move up in the status of volunteer as high as you can, maybe even doing some training on them, preparing them for adoption, things like that. So that, is, regardless of if you never use those skills again, you're learning a lot about working with different animals.
Mm-hmm.
And also working with people, and if you're helping to adopt out animals to individuals coming in to find a pet. So you still have to teach that person how to handle that dog, even if it's a simple project of being their pet. So that can be good. And then such as the blind camp, something like volunteering at one of those, because those are still in existence today. They're all over the country. Local blind organizations will often put on camps for youth during the summer. It can be a great way to be around individuals that have the challenge of blindness and getting a feel for what that's like as far as just being a good assistant in helping somebody understand the layout of an area, how to help them get from one place to another, what their basic daily needs are like, what their challenges are. That can be a really good experience for anyone interested in the field. A lot of people have come to this field strictly from the dog aspect and learned that other aspect once here. But even if you don't have any viable experience working with blind individuals, just being exposed to someone who is blind and what their challenges in life are can be very helpful in making that decision whether this would be a career for you anyway.
If there is such a thing, what's a typical day like for you?
Oh, a typical day for me is not very typical. Yes, I could give you maybe better idea of a typical day for a guide dog instructor. A guide dog instructor starts their day caring for their dogs they're assigned. One of our instructors is assigned to around four individual dogs that they're training. And so they're going to have these dogs for about 2 to 3 months, and they're working with them every weekday of the work week. And they're caring for them first thing in the morning, so basically doing things like cleaning up after them, grooming them if the dog is on any medication or needs to be rechecked by the vet clinic, taking care of all those needs, including feeding, first thing in the morning. So that would be like between 8 and 9 o'clock. And then at 9 o'clock, training would begin, and these dogs would be with that person all day long. So for guide dog training, we travel all over the place, giving the dog a lot of different work scenarios to get used to traveling in. So depending on the level the dog is at, that instructor would take their dogs to whatever area, urban, country roads, sidewalkless, suburban area, downtown Portland, to whatever area the dog is ready for, and give it a guide work lesson both in the morning and in the afternoon in those areas. And then in between time, the dog would be with them learning basic management in the environment. For instance, sitting down and having lunch, and the dog is under their feet at the table while they're having lunch. So the dog is learning other skills besides actually guiding the instructor. And then instructors, when they have their dogs finished training, they go through blindfold testing, which is always an exciting climax to guide dog training. They'll do like a 40-45 minute route under blindfold with their supervisor following and scoring the dog through downtown Portland. So very difficult and challenging routes with a lot of guide dog work challenges involved. Once the dog has passed and has become a qualified guide, the instructor takes those dogs they train into class with the clients that are assigned to come in. And the client has had a pre-application interview in their own home, regardless where that is in North America, so that not only can we inform them of what a guide dog can do and can't do for them, but we also can assess if their home living situation is suitable for a guide. There are some people that don't understand because they've never had a dog and don't realize that the status of their living room and their living area is so cluttered with stuff that it's not going to be practical to have a dog in there who's going to be picking all that stuff up and playing with it as if it was toys. So simple things like educating them about what it's like to have a dog in the house, but also then evaluating their mobility skills, taking them out for an assessment walk with an imaginary dog. And an imaginary dog being that we have a harness handle like the dog will wear, and the instructor is holding one end of it and the blind client applicant is holding the other. So the instructor can demonstrate to them how the dog will be working them through their environment. But when those dogs are trained, the instructor then takes those dogs to a class of students, and they will have two students. So let's say they have those four dogs ready to go. They have a bank of four dogs to match with these two individuals that they'll be working with very, very closely, in fact, practically living with this client, in residence here at one of our campuses for a few weeks and going out on several workout lessons a day with those dogs. And any dogs that they don't use end up going to the next instructor in line for potential matching of clients. A lot of times the clients are pre-matched by knowing them from past guide dogs or through the home interview process and video and logging the needs that that client has. The animal often is pretty much pre-matched, meaning that we know which dog Mrs. Jones is going to be given.
Can you start with a dog that the person owns and train them to be a guide dog?
We've never done that because if a dog is not prepared as a young dog to even enter guide dog training, they're going to have a hard time being successful. So very few pet dogs are of the temperament or raised in a manner that they're prepared to even enter guide dog work. That's why we have our very specialized puppy raising program. So we have puppy raising volunteer families all over the Western United States that raise our puppies that we have bred for this work. So if we took a dog that somebody had on their own as a pet and we assessed it, it would be likely that it wouldn't be suited to even enter guide dog training. Now, not to say that it couldn't work, I'm sure it could. It just the number of times it would successfully work would be minimal because of the type of dog you need to do guide work. You need a very, very solid temperament, personality of dog that's not at all worried or scared of the environment. And that includes things like trucks backfiring a few feet away from their head, a lady accidentally hitting them in the face with a shopping bag as they get on the bus. You know, there are a lot of things that a guide dog, you could say, endures as a guide they need to be the kind of dog that it just goes off them like nothing. That doesn't bother them.
Mm-hmm.
So the world can kind of be a challenging place.
So you breed these dogs?
Yeah, we have our own breeding program. So we breed and whelp approximately 800 to 900 puppies a year to serve about 350 to 360 blind clients per year.
Hmm. Wouldn't a bred guide dog make a wonderful family pet?
Very much so, and that's why we have a list of people waiting for dogs that we call career change.
Mm-hmm.
So either in the puppy raising program still, meaning they're under like 14 months of age, or informal training, if for some reason the dog is dropped from being a guide dog, that dog is available for other uses, including a family pet. So the raiser that raised the puppy has choice to have it back as a pet.
Ah.
And if they are busy, they have another puppy or dogs in the house and they don't want to add another one to the household, we have other avenues. We have several dogs that have been very successful for the hearing dog program.
Mm-hmm.
That we've donated to them. They just haven't been suitable for guides, but they've been exceptional for hearing dog work or service dog work. We have several career change dogs that are doing security work and nose detection work, such as like TSA work at the airports.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a percentage of dogs from our own breeding that we, of course, put back into our breeding colony as breeders. And those have pet homes also. So the dogs that we do breed in our colony are family pets.
Oh.
And they only come back to our facility in San Rafael when it's time to be bred or to whelp a litter, and some of those litters are also whelped in the homes.
So would Charlie Chaplin have a guide dog?
Would Charlie Chaplin have a guide dog?
I was looking.
Oh, you mean my freestyle?
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Well, because he didn't need a guide dog, he probably wouldn't have had one. You watched my video on my website.
I did. Well, it's like 200,000 people have watched your video. So.
Yeah, it's that's a pretty fun sport. So my hobby sport at this time and probably for the rest of my life will be canine freestyle. So it's a really, really fun sport that's extremely challenging.
So do you teach segments and then link them together?
Yes. Yeah, so if you look at that Charlie Chaplin routine on my website, that is, I believe, the behavior count in that routine is like 88 behavior cues,
mm.
which is mind-boggling when you think of it in terms of a clicker trainer. You'd be thinking of a chain of behaviors and a sequence. And the sequences at first are put together with very small chains. So there may only be three or four behaviors in a chain that are initially sequenced together.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of everything that my dog Listo does in that routine, every single thing he does as a single behavior, those were all taught individually first. And then when they're put together in a chain, they're put together with just a few at a time. And after those chains are fluent, meaning he's very good at them and reliable, then you start putting those sequences back to back and together.
Do you forward or backward chain?
Oh, definitely back chain as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because back chaining is so powerful.
Yes.
It's the learner knows right where they're going the whole time.
Right.
So back chaining is a very, very powerful tool. And in canine freestyle, it's very important because you have so many behaviors the dog is performing. And if the dog doesn't know the end, where they're going, that will become a bit overwhelming to the dog.
Mm-hmm.
So if when I start that routine, and one of the hardest behaviors for Listo to do is playing the dead dog at the beginning. So if I start that routine, I put him in that behavior. If I put him in that and he's looking at that as meaning, oh, I have a whole bunch of behaviors to do, it can be overwhelming to him.
Yeah, but at least he gets to start there and doesn't have to end there.
Exactly, right, exactly.
I've taught learning and memory for over 30 years. And two major findings of research are is distributed practice and backward training. And those are the two major things that my students do the least.
Well, it's interesting how our human instinct is to forward chain everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I continually have to remind my own freestyle students who come to me regularly when we start a sequence, they'll just start forward sequencing. And I'm, what are you doing? You know better than this. You know, to make it really powerful in the dog's mind, we want to start backwards.
Yes. So, Michelle, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Oh, I think freestyle is kind of my kick in the pants. It's because, you know, when you work with training guide dogs all day long, and that's your career, that's quite a serious subject. And there is a bit of inadvertent pressure on you knowing that this is training. These behaviors you're training could save someone's life. And it's important that those behaviors are fluent and are established, and you are giving a client a safe animal. So the idea of a guide dog not responding effectively to specific cues can be a little worrisome. In canine freestyle, I could care less. So if my dog messes up during a training session or even during a performance, it can be a laughable situation. Mm-hmm. It's just freestyle. It's fun. We're there to have fun. And when everything goes well, it's phenomenal. And it's really exciting. It's a fun sport. I like the idea that it also is entertaining to people who even know nothing about dog training.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't like you have to know anything about freestyle to enjoy watching a good performance.
That's true.
But it also, because it's just fun and it's creative and it makes me use my creative juices to try to think of new ways to interpret music or new moves to put on a dog that can be entertaining to both the dog and the audience, I think that is my kick in the pants. It's kind of a way to enjoy the dog training, the science of it, because, wow, without clicker training, very, very hard to create a good freestyle dog. Clicker
yeah.
training is just imperative when you look at some of those challenging behaviors. I would challenge any traditional trainer to train some of those behaviors.
Well, poor dog. Let me turn the question around. When you have to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Oh, usually I do that by grooming my horses or my dogs. For some reason, grooming is very relaxing for me. I'm an avid movie watcher, too. Love to go to a good movie and just escape. I really like an adventure movie
mm-hmm.
or a comedy.
Yeah.
And those are like my favorite ways to just kind of relax and unwind and not have to think and just lose myself in the fantasy.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Oh, I would probably have to say losing people very close to me from cancer.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I've lost three people very close to me. And that has been really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, getting through those has also, you know, really been through my animals, too. So, you know, I lost the love of my life, someone who was only 38 years of age. And the fact that the dogs and the horses still needed to get fed and cared for through the day really actually got me through the first few months of that. Because, you know, they didn't obviously act like anything was different. Their world basically was the same. So I really thank goodness, I thank God that I had those animals, because they really actually grounded me to how life continues, life goes on.
If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say?
I would definitely say that following your passion, what you really want to do, can be difficult and maybe be a longer road to success. But, I mean, I would always support somebody finding out something that they love to do and doing it. Now, it can be that you find something you're good at and you turn it into your passion. That can work too. Because I think to really be able to have passion for something you do, you also have to be somewhat good at it. So that might mean that you need to develop your skills longer term, or it might mean that you have to find another passion if you realize that you're not suited for that specific passion. For instance, I just think ballet dancing is just remarkable. But I'm realistic enough to know early on that there was no way I had what it took to be a ballet dancer. But I think that the passion in your work is important. I'm coming into my 38th year in guide dog work, and I have to say I still love coming to work every day. And the reason is I have a passion for the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it doesn't mean it has to be guide dog work, but that anything that you do for a career, you need to find the passion in it. I had a funny thing happen to me when I was doing a terrible job just in between my professional horse career and turning to dogs. I was selling advertising over the phone. For about 6 months, I was sitting at this grungy little desk and had this grungy little phone. And for 4 hours a day, I would call up businesses and try to sell them ads. And I just hated it. And I was in the car on the way to this terrible little job. And on the radio, some disc jockey said, "Well, you know what, guys, if you have to do it, you might as well enjoy it." And that really resonated with me. And I got through the next 6 months of that job actually enjoying it. So not that I knew I wanted to make it my career, I didn't, but I did find what there was in that job that I was going to benefit from and how I was going to gain some experience, and I actually ended up not detesting going to work in the morning. So it was changing your outlook on, instead of just focusing again on negatives, I was focusing on, you know what, I'm actually getting some good phone skills with this job. I'm learning how to read people. I'm learning how to give them some feedback that makes them want to talk with me longer, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't always have to be what your dream is, but I think you do need to find passion and try to find a way to maintain it in what you do as work.
I want to thank Michelle Pulley for joining me today. Thanks, Michelle. I appreciate it.
You are so welcome.
If you'd like to leave a comment, ask a question, or get more info, go to whatsitlike.info.